Everyone, this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs to order. It is now 8:02 a.m. Tuesday, March 12th, 2019 in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Kopp, Representative Lincoln, Vice Chair Edgman, Representative Ortiz, Representative Vance, and myself, Representative Zilkuski, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would just ask everyone in the room to please take a moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you in advance. Before we begin, I would also like to thank House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs Committee Aide Grace Singh, Lori Rowland, the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. We will begin today's hearing on tribal compacts, contracts, and consultation with a presentation from Valerie Nuchagaluk Davidson. Ms. Davidson worked in tribal health for 15 years, serving 12 of those years as co-lead negotiator for the Alaska Tribal Health Compact with the Indian Health Service. She was also the chair of the National Tribal Advisory Group for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also known as CMS. Ms. Davidson, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation. And as Ms. Davidson prepares to give her presentation, I would like to recognize Commissioner Johnson. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be back in the room again under different circumstances. Today, I was asked to provide some perspective and opportunities on contracting, compacting, and the opportunities that provides states, including Alaska, for tribal, state, and federal partnerships. So typically, the way that partnerships, compacting and contracting has started has been under federal law, not only in Alaska, but also the rest of the United States of America. And typically, that has been authorized under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. And this federal law authorizes tribes and tribal organizations that have the authority from tribes to be able to contract or compact with the federal government for programs, services, functions, or activities that the federal government would otherwise provide for American Indians and Alaska Natives. And so that phrase, programs, functions, services, or activities, is a key phrase as we're talking about compacting. So anytime we talk about compacting and the special relationship between the federal government and American Indians and Alaska Natives, we always get the question, wait a minute, isn't that racism? Is there something going on here? Really, it's a recognition of the political relationship, the government-to-government relationship between the federal government and tribes. And it's not a race-based relationship. That has been recognized repeatedly. That trust relationship has been recognized repeatedly and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's an important distinction to make. So folks also ask, okay, there's a contract and there's also a compact. What's the difference? Generally, in a nutshell, and you can see in this side-by-side and slide number three, I should have numbered these slides. Contracting tribes will typically start with a contract and then they will graduate to a compact. Not always, but that's typically the way that it works. They both get their authority under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. Contracting is through Title I, compacting is through Title V. You can see the references for the U.S. Code as well as the corresponding regulations. If any of you are up at night and you're interested in learning more about all of the legalities of compacting, it is not what I could call light reading, but perhaps if you're having trouble sleeping, it might just put you right out there pretty quickly. Both require a resolution from the tribe authorizing the tribe to be able to negotiate with the federal government on their behalf. The difference between contracting and compacting in terms of authority is for the compact, since it's generally more more authority. It requires, in addition to a resolution, it requires a successful completion of a planning phase, and it also requires three years of fiscal stability and management. So typically, that's satisfied by 3 years of clean audits. So in contracting versus compacting allows a lot more flexibility and a lot more local control versus contracting. So here's an example in real life. In the region that I'm from, and I certainly don't want to speak for a tribe or tribal organization, they are more than qualified to do that on their behalf. But in the region that I'm from, in the Bethel area, many years ago, even before I started in tribal health, when YKHC, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, first began taking over programs and services, they began with a contract before they did a full-blown compact for all of the health services in the region, including taking over the hospital. So tribes and tribal organizations will often start with a contract, but not necessarily. It really depends on their readiness and their ability and their interest in taking on additional responsibility. So in Alaska, typically with the federal government, there are two different kinds of compacts, typically. There's the Alaska Tribal Health Compact, which has 25 or maybe 26 co-signers, and that is a compact between tribes and tribal organizations and the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That's on the left side. On the right side, you can see there's another kind of compact that tribes and tribal organizations compact with the Secretary of the Department of Interior. So the health compact, no surprise, really compacts for health kinds of health services, but includes more than just basic health care. It includes community health care. It includes research and data. They have an epidemiology center. They do technology, telehealth, health training, rural energy, sanitation and health facility construction management, wellness and prevention, and other activities as well. On the BIA side, on the interior side, they typically will do child and family services, including Indian Child Welfare Act services, economic development, education, employment, and training, elder services, natural resources, public safety, TANF, transportation, and tribal justice.
I'd like to take a moment to recognize Representative Jackson. Thank you for joining us today, as well as John Mueller from the Governor's Office.
So some folks have asked, well, you know, what are the benefits? Why do people do compacting? Well, for the tribes in the communities, and for actually anybody who lives in rural Alaska and throughout rural Alaska, you have a lot more local control. And in fact, some of our larger health organizations in our state are not only rural-based, but there are also urban-based organizations as well. I know that when the legislature was working through Senate Bill 74, which was the Medicaid reform bill, a lot of the innovations that the state was interested in seeing for all of their citizens already exist in the tribal health system. And so that bill was a way for our state to be able to ensure that the rest of the Alaska citizens, regardless of where they lived, had those same opportunities. So what we've seen is better coordinated care for beneficiaries. For example, for all practical purposes, the tribal health system really serves a large public health function in our state. Other states have county health systems, and they are very robust county health systems. Alaska doesn't have counties, so hence no county health system. Just to give you a sense of the scale, the Department of Health and Social Services has about 3,500 employees. Collectively, the Alaska Tribal Health System has about 7,000 employees. So you can get a sense of what that scale is and the different kinds of services that are available. But if you live in a rural community, if you're a teacher, if you're a trooper, if you happen to be traveling and you need health care, typically the tribal health provider who is providing services under a compact is often the only health care provider that is available. And they do have 813 resolutions where they will see anyone who presents for care.
Representative Edgman.
Welcome back, Commissioner Davidson. Nice to see you. Thank you for being here this morning. So I was looking at the rest of your slides, and I hope I'm not preempting maybe a message that's coming coming on down the pike here. But I was wondering, since you're here, I'd like to get your perspective on the proposed cuts to Medicaid and what and how that might fit into this picture.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Edgman, I'm going to try and answer this very carefully. One of the things that we have seen in Medicaid is an incredible opportunity to be able to extend coverage for people in Alaska who have not otherwise had coverage before. Whether it is providing for behavioral health services, which has been critical, providing resources that have been critical for dealing with the opioid epidemic, for helping to reduce recidivism, all of those things come into play. And so the challenge we have is that while the compact is available and provides health services, it does not provide all of the health services and does not provide all of the resources available to a tribe or tribal organization for providing that service. In fact, based on the federal government's own analysis of their availability of resources, they found that the tribal health system in Alaska is only funded at about 50% of the level of funding needed to be able to provide the most basic health care services. And since they are so underfunded, Congress passed a number of laws that requires tribal health organizations to seek third-party reimbursement. So they don't have an option. They are required to do that. So they seek third-party reimbursement in the way the examples are private insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, Denali KidCare, which is our state's children's health insurance program, and any other kind, and also self-pay in certain instances. And so since tribes are only funded at 50% of the level of funding needed, and they rely on that third-party revenue, anytime there is a change to that coverage makeup or to the available resources, then that's a challenge for them to be able to continue to provide that service.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. Thank you for that response. I just knowing your background with the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and certainly as the former Commissioner of Health and Social Services, I thought you were more than qualified to offer at least some perspective on that. And I didn't want to drag you into one of our political fights down here, but just wanted to take advantage of being here.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Edgman, I appreciate that, but I think in a nutshell, the moral of the story is anytime that there are few resources available out there for coverage and for services, that impacts any health provider's ability to provide that care, and that also extends to tribal providers as well.
So before you continue, just for the purposes of providing some clarifying information, we did invite Ms. Davidson to speak here today based on her previous experience in tribal compacting and contracting to speak to defining those functions. So I would just ask committee members to be advised of the limited scope of her invitation to join us today. So if you could please continue with your presentation.
Oyana, Madam Chair. So in addition to the public health function, as I mentioned before, there are many parts of the state where there is no public health program on the ground 24/7. And so the tribal health programs that are in those communities serve in that role. The other thing that has happened is it used to be in terms of our veterans in our state really benefit from the tribal health system as well. It used to be, I'll use, let's say I have an uncle who lives in Guiginluk, who is a veteran. When he needed care from the veteran, and he was a veteran, so he earned that coverage and he earned that benefit. He would have to travel from Guiginluk to Bethel to Anchorage, which was the nearest Veterans Administration facility, to be able to be screened to determine what he needed. Then he would be sent back from Anchorage to Bethel to Guiginluk, and then he would be told later, yes, you come back for your service, and he would have to travel repeatedly back and forth. Even though there was a clinic in Guiginluk that may have been able to provide his care, and even though there was a hospital in Bethel that was able to provide the level of care that he needed. Now, through agreements with the Veterans Administration and the tribal health system, my uncle can now receive his care in a tribal health facility. And what that does is it really extends those relationships and extends those agreements, and it also ensures that he doesn't have that disruption of travel. And what we know and what we've learned in, you know, the approximately 40 years that healthcare has been delivered in Alaska through the compact, that when you can provide care as close to home as possible, we have much better outcomes. It's the transitions and the travel from one community to another and one system to another where things can go wrong. We also have care coordination agreements between tribes and between tribal organizations and non-tribal organizations through a tribal claiming policy that was negotiated with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And let me give you an example of what that means. It not only makes good sense from a programmatic perspective, but it also means real dollar savings for everyone, especially for the state. So care coordination agreements are required by CMS, by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that allow, if three things come together, if you have an IHS beneficiary, which is an Alaska Native person or American Indian person like me, who is also, the second thing, a Medicaid beneficiary, so let's pretend I'm a Medicaid beneficiary. And the third thing is if that person is seen through, the magic language is through an IHS facility, which includes tribally operated facilities like we have here in Alaska. If those three things come together, then the state no longer has to do 50% federal match. The state is actually entitled to 100% federal match by the federal government. So it used to be that the federal government interpreted through an IHS facility very, very strictly, and it had to be within those four walls of the facility. But since they enhanced the tribal claiming policy understanding, now as long as there's a care coordination agreement, things that are considered, additional things that are considered for 100% federal match are travel, medically necessary travel, to get a patient, an IHS beneficiary who's a Medicaid beneficiary, to the right facility. And the other thing that's 100% now is care that is referred outside of the tribal health system. So here's how it used to be. Let's say, God forbid, I had a heart attack and I was in Bethel and I needed to be flown to Anchorage to see a cardiologist and to have my heart worked on. And I went to ANMC. If I was a Medicaid beneficiary, that would be considered 100% federal match. So the provider still gets the same, gets paid the same. They get the paid the same rate whether whether I'm 100% or not. The provider gets paid the same rate. So it doesn't make a difference to the actual provider. It makes a huge difference to the state. If I'm seen at ANMC, it's 100% federal match. And it used to be that if ANMC said, well, you, this is too complicated of a case and you now have to go to Providence or Alaska Regional or you have to go down south, once I crossed that threshold, once I crossed that door out of that facility, I was no longer considered 100% federal match. It was now 50%. So anytime a person left the tribal health system, it costs the state 50% more in state in general fund. So the new rule, though, and the new interpretation that was negotiated allows for a care coordination agreement that says as long as there is a care coordination agreement between the referring IHS facility and a non-IHS facility, where the care started at an IHS facility and was referred to a non-IHS facility, and that patient has a care coordination agreement to come back to that facility, that is now considered 100% federal match. So because of that care coordination agreement, those leveraged partnerships really have resulted in some pretty significant general fund savings. In state fiscal year 17, the state saved $35 million in state GF in Medicaid expenditures through the tribal claiming policy. In state fiscal year 18, the state saved $44.7 million. In state fiscal year 19, year to date, the state has saved $46 million over just the first two quarters. They were projected to save between $64 to $84 million. So to date, since state fiscal year 2017, the state has saved $125.7 million in Medicaid general fund in state match. And so not only does it make good sense from a patient perspective, from a quality care perspective, it also makes really, really good fiscal sense, and it makes good budget sense for the state to continue to work with tribes and tribal organizations to make sure that these kinds of arrangements continue.
As a clarifying question related to the care coordination agreements, and I apologize if you've already gone over this, is that incorporated as part of the Tribal Health Compact?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. So the care coordination agreements are a requirement of CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they, in order for them to be considered 100% federal match, the compact comes into play because it has to be an IHS facility, and an IHS facility is determined by their participation in typically Schedule E of the Alaska Tribal Health Compact and the corresponding funding agreement.
Thank you.
I realize I just got all legalese on you there. Apologize. But yes, it has to be adequately described as a service in the compact, and it has to be, the facility has to be included in the facility list for that to be included.
Representative Edgman.
So maybe just to dive in that just a little bit more, can you explain, you know, from the perspective of the umbrella organization, ANTHC, sure, down to the providers, where does a compact need to exist, and could you have a compact and a contract, for example, that might work hand in glove, or is it just ANTHC with the compact and everything else just sort of is in place thereof?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Edgman, great question. So the 25 or 26 co-signers to the compact are actually, and I don't want to speak for them, but I can tell you from what I know from past experience, the co-signers are actually independent legal entities, and so they typically will provide service in a service area. So, for example, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, which is where I'm from, so they will always be my example, provides health care to 58 federally recognized tribes in an area approximately the size of the state of Oregon, or about 75,000 square miles. Their sister tribal organization, Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation, independent, legally distinct tribal organization, they are also legally distinct from the statewide tribal organization, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And ANTHC, a statewide tribal health organization, provides statewide services and a lot of the functions that used to be provided by the Indian Health Service Area Office. And all of the, a number of the tribal organizations are represented on the ANTHC board. So they are connected.
Thank you.
But they are legally distinct organizations.
Thank you for the clarification.
So while our most experience in Alaska has really been in federal compacts with the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Interior, there are also opportunities that exist with state compacts. The state has right now an existing Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact, which is a government-to-government agreement with 18 co-signers representing over 160 tribes. It recognizes tribes' inherent sovereignty in Alaska, and it also recognizes that tribes may be in a better position to be able to provide a variety of child welfare services on their own behalf, recognizing the model that happened in tribal health and also the model that happened in other BIA programs. When you can provide care and services as close to home as possible, we will often have better health, we will often have better outcomes. And so applying that same opportunity to child welfare really was the next logical step. And as that compact was being negotiated, you know, when you're trying something new and trying something different, change can be really, really hard. And so beyond just sort of the intellectual activity and the intellectual exercise and the practicalities of changing programs, you're also dealing with people who do this really hard work. It's hard work, but it's also really hard work. And sometimes it's hard for people to let go. And the way that I think about it is that people have cared for these programs, you know, sometimes from infancy, and they've seen these programs and these services develop and mature over time. But like every good parent, and maybe this isn't the right analogy, there comes a time when it's appropriate and it's okay, and in fact, it's the responsible thing to do to watch that become the next evolution, to turn that over to the world, to watch that person, watch that program really launch in a way that's healthier for everyone. I'm not going to talk about the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact at great length, because you're going to have, I think, more opportunity later to hear from folks who may have more current information. But one of the things that was really, really important is change is hard. It's an emotional exercise as well as an intellectual, legal, and programmatic one. And so it's important to send a really strong message that we were on a path to yes. No matter what was happening, no matter how hard it was, people will come up with all kinds of reasons for why something can't be done. And what we said at the time was, we are on a path to yes. The answer will always be, yes, we can do that if we can overcome these obstacles. Yes, we can do that if we can satisfy these federal requirements, which every state has to satisfy. So if you change your thinking a little bit and you think about the path to yes, suddenly your world becomes a lot more possible. So now that the state has done a compact with tribes and tribal organizations, and there is nothing in state law that precludes that from happening, and you'll sometimes hear people say, well, is there actual express authority? And while there may not be express authority in some instances, there's also no authority that precludes that from happening. And so other areas may be possible as well. I know that education is a possibility, and the commissioner of the Department of Education was looking at that. It was one of the recommendations of the committee that took place over a couple of years. There's also opportunities in public safety. There are opportunities in transportation, and there are so many opportunities. And sometimes when you're thinking about providing a service, if we really, really care about the service and the service needs to be provided, we also have to own the responsibility of asking the hard question of, are we the right person? Are we the right people to provide that service? Is someone else in a better position to provide that service, maybe because of location, maybe because of experience, etc. But one of the things that is really, really important that we grappled with also in the Child Welfare Compact is that you can't just transfer the responsibility. You can't just transfer the authority over. We have to set people up for success. And so we also need to make sure that compacts are adequately funded. And if you transfer the responsibility without any of the resources, that's not really a healthy situation for anybody, because we need to make sure that people are successful.
Ms. Davidson, my question is not to get too in the weeds or granular on the components of the Tribal Child Welfare Compact, but can you give an example to help illuminate some of the compactable points that are included within an agreement of that nature?
Madam Chair, yes, I can. So the biggest thing that the compact did is it provided, the department agreed to provide information to tribes, any co-signer to the compact, to any tribe, reports of harm for the first time that they occurred. And so the way that it used to be is that that information wasn't shared with tribes until it rose to the level of an investigation, and they had to be a screened-in report for investigation and further look. So sometimes in child welfare cases, you may have five reports of harm, and it isn't until the fifth one that rises to the level of something's happening and a formal action needs to be taken by the state. Now, because if the family isn't getting the care and the intervention that they need, then we know that as families have more pressure, they're under more, they're more likely that children may be neglected or in fact may be harmed. With the Child Welfare Compact, every report of harm, the first time it is reported, that information is now shared with the tribe or the tribal organization at its first instance. And what that allows the tribe to be able to do is to be able to wrap, they know who's having trouble in that community or in that region, and they're able to wrap services around that child and that family. So maybe there will only be one report of harm. There won't be five, and there won't have to be a more formal intervention down the line. Tribes are also interested in and have done diligent relative searches, so looking for relatives for the child, for Indian Child Welfare Act cases, making sure that they are, that the state is able to comply with that requirement of placing that Indian child with a relative to comply with federal law. Tribes have also done, are interested in doing licensing of foster homes, and their other tribes are interested in actually assuming all of the services that are currently being provided by the Office of Children's Services. So just like the contract and the compact that happened, we were talking about at the federal level, tribes themselves really determine what they're interested in and what they're capable of and the trajectory on which they would like to provide in terms of their scope of service and also how quickly they ramp up that service.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So again, it's really, really important that the adequate resources are there, and one of the components that we provided, that was provided for in the Tribal Child Welfare Compact, are indirect rates. And indirect rates basically, and I know you're going to hear more in a minute, but in a nutshell, the moral of the story for indirect rates is it provides an indirect rate for all of the things that the state would normally be allowed to have. So for example, at the Department of Health and Social Services, it's not just the department that provides that service. They also have the resources of the Department of Administration to help them administer services to employees, insurance plans, etc. They also have access to the attorney, to the Department of Law and the services of the Attorney General, etc., etc. And so those indirect rates and the indirect part helps to compensate and helps to provide additional resources for those administrative type functions. So rent for facilities helps to provide coverage and insurance for employees, keeps the lights on, the buildings open, etc. And so all of those things as well. But I know you're going to hear more about indirect here shortly. And then finally, so there's also some confusion folks have about, okay, there's contracting, there's compacting, there's federal compacting, there's federal contracting, there's state compacting. How does consultation come into play? So consultation, that as I'm familiar with, happens in two different environments. One, at the federal level, they have very, very strong consultation policies. Every department has a consultation policy. There are some consultation policies that are really, really tight. For example, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which administers all Medicaid programs, all Medicare programs, and also children's health insurance programs, et cetera. CMS has a tribal consultation policy that requires, it's very tight, it requires this. Before a state submits a state plan amendment and before CMS will approve any state's plan for amendment, so when you're administering a Medicaid program, you have to have a state plan amendment. If you want to make changes to your Medicaid program, you have to submit a state plan amendment to CMS, our federal partners. And CMS requires that before they approve that state plan, that state has to demonstrate that they have adequately consulted with tribes. It's a requirement under federal law. And so if a state has not adequately consulted with tribes about any change to the state plan, the Medicaid state plan amendment, then CMS has the authority to be able to decline that state plan amendment. And so the state would not be able to make that change to their Medicaid policy. It's very rare that that happens. Typically what will happen is rather than CMS actually formally declining that, typically they will invite the state to withdraw their state plan amendment to do further work. And that has happened in the past. There was another state that was invited to withdraw their state plan, although they had indicated that they had consulted with tribes. When the CMS inquired with tribes in that state, the tribe said no, there was not adequate consultation. They pretty much invited us to a meeting. They checked the box. It was not a meaningful conversation. It was not adequate consultation. And so the feds, particularly CMS, take consultation very, very seriously. We also see consultation happening in state environments. Other states have really, really strong consultation policies. There are states who routinely do consultation with tribes in a very formalized way. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has a consultation policy that was signed by Commissioner Butler. That was a really comprehensive tribal consultation policy. The Alaska Department of Transportation has had a tribal consultation policy for quite some time. And Administrative Order 300 required, among other things, required every department to develop consultation policies. So consultation policies really allow a very formalized structure for conversations and really meaningful dialogue to happen between tribes and tribal organizations and the state. And so it's government to government. It's a really wonderful opportunity for them to really understand in a formalized way, what can you offer, what can we do in a way that helps to be able to move everybody forward. Those consultation opportunities are also really great. Sometimes I don't understand either, that's okay. those consultation opportunities also allow ways for the state and tribes to be able to talk about what are the other compacting possibilities, things that we have found to be helpful in other areas that may be helpful here. And I'll leave you with this last.
Ms. Davidson, before you move on, can I ask you a clarifying question? You had mentioned that AO 300 required every state department to develop consultation policies. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes.
Do you know when that administrative order was signed and or the status of it?
Madam Chair, the administrative order was signed, I think, a little over a year ago. My date might be off. And I believe the administrative order is still standing. I haven't heard that it has been rescinded.
Thank you.
So let me offer another perspective that may help frame this discussion in terms of compacting and contracting and consultation in the world of what might be possible. And I'll do it in a classic Yupik fashion to tell a little story. So Yupiks believe that that your view of the world is entirely shaped by your experiences. And so it's considered really, really impolite to tell somebody that they're wrong, even if you have a different perspective and even if their reality may be so off that everybody believes that they are wrong. You would never tell them that because they haven't had that experience. Here's an example. When my nephew was three, we were sitting there in a little coffee shop. Don't worry, I wasn't giving him coffee at three. He had a juice and I was drinking a coffee. And he pointed at something on the table and he said, "Anani," which is auntie, he said, "Can you hand me that thing? It's that orange thing." There was only one thing on the table and it was green. It was not orange. And I said, "What?" He said, "Can you hand me that orange thing right there?" And I picked it up and I said, "This?" And he said, "Yeah." And I picked it up and I looked at him and I said, "Jacob, this kind of orange is called green." And he said, "Oh, okay. Nani, can you hand me that green thing?" And I said, "Sure." And I handed it to him. So as we're thinking about compacting and contracting and the way we do our work, I would really encourage you to think about the fact that sometimes we may be seeing something that we believe is orange because that's all that we've ever known. And we need to be open to the possibility that that thing might also be green, and it might be green to somebody else. And we need to be open to the possibility that it might be green, and compacting and consultation and contracting is very much something that is green. With that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Koyana, very much for the opportunity.
Koyana, Ms. Davidson, for your incredible service to Alaska tribes and the entire state of Alaska. I would just ask if you wouldn't mind staying in the room, we might invite you back to provide some closing comments or clarifying points following today's presentations. We will now turn to a presentation by Ms. Corrine Garza. Ms. Garza was Tlingit and Haida's chief operating officer for 19 years. Corrine is both Haida, Eagle Frog Sculpin, her Haida name is Saksani, and Tlingit Raven Koho, Donna Shawat Moneywoman. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in Economics from Stanford and a Master's in Business Administration from the University of Washington. Ms. Garza, please put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Corrine Garza, good morning. My presentation will be briefer, I hope, but normally it's not when you start talking about money. So I was asked to speak on indirect and the federal regulations concerning audits and indirect are found in the federal regulations with respect to federal indirect rates are found in 2 CFR Part 225. And so that's just the federal code of regulations. In addition, tribes must follow generally accepted accounting principles. So audits are conducted every year. And of course, costs. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not keeping up with this. The costs are classified in various manners, which are basically direct costs. And those include compensation, materials, equipment, travel, and they're identified with a specific cost objective. Indirect costs are incurred for a common purpose, such as finance, computer information services, and they're pretty much everyone uses that service in the organization. Also, indirect costs are costs that are not assignable without a lot of work to assign those costs, such as copying, long distance, cell phone calls, et cetera. Spend more time classifying that than you would actually the cost of the service. And then there's also another category of costs called unallowable costs, and these are all federal costs, which is really where my experience is. And these are like contributions, donations, fines, penalties, fundraising and investment management costs, general government expenses, except as provided under the Self-Determination Act, contingencies, lobbying, and under-recovery of costs under federal agreements. And those costs are kept in a separate pool. And tribes are not allowed to recover for those kinds of costs.
Ms. Garza, may I ask a question?
Sure.
What are the types of organizations in Alaska that have established indirect rates or costs?
Well, tribes have indirect rates, but I think organizations like universities negotiate indirect rates with the federal government. Nonprofits that provide service may also negotiate indirect rates. Any organization that receives federal funding negotiates indirect rates with the feds, and depending on where you get the majority of your federal funding is then will determine which federal organization you negotiate that indirect rate with.
Thank you. Please continue.
So basically your costs are divided into the four different categories that I spoke about, which are direct, indirect, administrative, and unallowable. And all costs for an indirect cost proposal must be must tie to the audit. So you can't just make up any numbers that you want to make up. They must be tied to the audit. And all variations must be identified. The Interior Business Center, who negotiates these agreements for tribes, typically will require a breakdown of even meeting fees to make sure we are only charging 50% to the indirect cost pool. So I know there's a lot of discussion or misunderstanding that tribes just throw everything into these indirect cost pools, but that's not the case. The Interior Business Center doesn't want the federal government to pay for things like donations and other costs that are not allowable. And so they will request a breakdown of certain costs anytime they feel like it when they're negotiating these agreements. So, of course, limitations on the indirect are, and this is with the federal government as well as with the state, there are indirect cap. Indirect caps limit are limitations on how much a tribe may recover in indirect or, well, maybe not just a tribe, but for example, a rural cap also manages a Head Start program. But these programs are the ones that I know about that have indirect cap limitations, and that's Head Start has an indirect cap limitation of 15%. TANF has an indirect cap limitation of 15% on client benefits. Community Service Block Grant is federal program. Village Public Safety Officer has a cap, as well as child care. Excuse me, my voice is giving out on me. So when programs have a cap, that limits the contractors that are going to participate in those programs, because those caps create shortfalls, and shortfalls are real money losses. They are not paper losses. And so most smaller tribes do not have another source of unrestricted revenue, and so they can't afford to make up those shortfalls. Because sometimes people have the concept that the shortfall is a paper loss, but if you're only getting 90% of your indirect reimbursed, you have a 10% shortfall, you can't tell your employees, I'm only going to pay you 90% of your paycheck. You can't tell the fuel companies, I'm only going to pay you 90% of your oil bill, because that's all I got reimbursed. So I just wanted to make that point.
Representative Edgman has a question.
Yes.
So very interesting conversation. I have to profess my ignorance with tribal auditing. I've been familiar with auditing with a private company, for-profit, non-for-profit. Been involved in quite a few of those. But going back to the previous presentation, there was reference to being, to be eligible for compact, and you had to have 3 years of fiscal stability and management, and I guess in parentheses, auditing. So when the audit occurs, and I assume it's a fairly conventional auditor, KPMG or whomever that could come in and do this, the focus on indirect rates, and also sort of the focus on the tribal entity keeping good sets of books, quote unquote, is pretty important. Is that the correct statement?
Yes. The feds require copies of your audits, as well as the state. The state gets copies of our audits. And in fact, I know at Clinkett and Haida post copies of their audits on their website, just so that everyone knows, how the money is spent. But yes.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to sort of emphasize that point, because in our journey in terms of better understanding what tribes do and don't, and certainly their legitimacy as viable entities, I think this is a pretty important point to sort of emphasize, because clearly there's a lot of cities who have difficulty in getting their audits done, their books done, and we have what's called local government specialists that go out and work with cities and with tribes to some degree. But just wanted to take a pause there and emphasize that tribes are held to pretty high standards.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you don't submit your audit, then you'll get a letter, and maybe your funds withheld. So it's to your benefit to get your audit done and on time.
Please continue.
Okay. So one example of the indirect cap is there is a shared cap at the VPSO program, and this is the state VPSO program. There is no federal VPSO program. And all of the organizations, which are tribes and nonprofit regional organizations that participate, agreed to, because they all have different indirect cap rates, agreed to a pool of money that was available for indirect, and that pool was capped at 30% for the entire sum of. So some organizations might have a lower rate and others might have a higher rate, and so those with the higher rate get reimbursed and those with the lower rate don't go up to the 30%. So is that clear? Okay.
I'd like to recognize Representative Hopkins has joined us. Thank you for joining us. Please continue.
So the tribal contractors, of course, always take efforts to minimize their indirect rates because it helps to get grants if you have a lower rate, and so people aren't trying to build up their indirect rates, they're trying to lower their indirect rates. Now I know that's something that the state is familiar with in terms of trying to cut their budgets and trying to be more efficient. Similarly, tribes have the same goal in mind, and a lot of efforts that we've taken, or at least the tribe took in recent years, that I'm familiar with is we were offered as tribes the opportunity in the to participate in the federal insurance program. Before that, we were in the AFN program, and our rates were very, very high, and so we were able to switch from the AFN program over to the federal program and lower our insurance rates across the tribe, when we had like 200 employees, so that makes a big impact. That creates savings, that lowers your indirect rate. So those are the kinds of efforts that tribes participate in and trying to get their rates lowered. I know that at Central Council, and I'm not representing Central Council today, I'm representing myself. At Central Council, though, when I was there, there were other efforts to lower indirect rates. For example, we hired our own in-house counsel because our legal fees were growing quite a bit. And so everyone takes those kind of efforts to minimize their rates, is the point I'm trying to get to. So one of the ways that tribes have had to try to minimize the shortfall that they get while still trying to provide services is to develop what are called administrative rates or administrative pools of money. And that method of recovering our administrative costs was approved in the Rama settlement, which was a big lawsuit that the tribes filed against the federal government and won. And so the tribe does develop administrative pools and administrative rates for Head Start, BPSO, and what, so how these administrative rates are developed is you must track your costs in pools and be able to identify the services with those costs. So, for example, like one of the tribe's biggest costs is facilities. But when we looked at the VPSO program, for example, the VPSO program, the staff, the VPSO officers were located in the communities, and the communities are the ones that had to provide the space. So in our administrative pool for VPSO, in order to drive that rate down for that program, we segregated our facilities costs and then just charged the administrative pool for one space rather than for all of the VPSO officers. So those are the kinds of efforts that tribes take in trying to provide the service while still living with these caps. So not all tribes are going to be able to do that. You really need to have some economies of scale and some really pretty sophisticated people in your finance department. So how this works is the programs with administrative pools are subtracted from the direct base. The amount of indirect that's recovered is subtracted from the indirect pool, and then you do all this math here and you get administrative rates for each of those programs and then an overall indirect rate for the remaining programs. Any questions on that? So the Interior Business Center at the Department of Interior is the one that approves of indirect cost proposals for tribes. Now, some tribes are negotiate their rates with the Interior Business Center's counterpart in the Department of Health and Social Services. But the Interior Business Center requires tribes to follow their template to derive carry forwards, and tribes do calculate carry forwards. It's a very complicated formula of determining over and under recoveries. Over recoveries occur when the tribe collects more indirect from a program than is apportioned to that program from the indirect cost pool. That rarely happens, but I just wanted to give that example.
Ms. Garza?
Yeah.
I'm unfamiliar with the Interior Business Center. Can you describe for our committee where that's located?
It's located in the Department of Interior.
Thank you.
So it's the department that negotiates indirect with tribes and with other organizations. But in any case, the over recovery is subtracted from the pool 2 years in the future. So I know that this is kind of getting a little complicated, but it might be more than you want to know. So if I'm going into too much detail, let me know.
Please continue.
The same thing happens with under recovery that results in an increase in the next period's rate because you're adding that under recovery of indirect expenses to the rate 2 years into the future. Shortfalls, on the other hand, are a whole different calculation because you don't get a shortfall back. Shortfalls occur when there is a cap on a grant, which is less than the approved indirect rate. So if, for example, the tribe has an indirect rate, an administrative indirect rate of that they were able to derive from all these calculations of 35%, and the pool rate was 30% from BPSO, and then they would have a 5% shortfall. That 5% shortfall is a real loss. It's not paper loss. So carry forwards occur when the overall recovery deviates from the budgeted amount. And so as a state, you know that you have a budget, but you don't always, things don't always follow the budget to the precise amount. So there's always going to be variances, and that's what these variances deal with. But the shortfalls will not be recovered. Carry forwards can be recovered. And the deficit is, at least for tribes, consists of both the shortfall and a carry forward if there's an under recovery. So tribes have to make certifications in their indirect cost proposals, and most of the time the state will honor the indirect cost rates that are negotiated because they're aware of the process that tribes have to go through to get these indirect rates. But the tribes have to certify that all the costs are allowable in accordance with federal requirements. And I just gave you a brief glimpse at what the unallowable costs were, but there's actually more extensive, you know, things that are unallowable in the rules. They have to certify that there's not any unallowable costs included in the calculation of those rates, that any excluded costs pay for their own administrative costs, so that that pool of unallowable expenses also gets its share of indirect that the tribe must pick up, must pick up as well. And that all costs are allocable, this is a federal word, allocable, on the basis of beneficial or causal relationships. So really have to spend the money. If it's a Head Start dollar, it needs to be spent on a Head Start activity. If it's an indirect dollar, it must be spent on an indirect activity. You can't be shifting those costs in between cost objectives. So those are the kinds of certifications that tribes have to make when they submit their proposal. And the Interior Business Center, the tribe submits the proposal. Interior Business Center approves or disapproves of all the costs. The tribes have to justify all the expenses in the pool. And then the Interior Business Center issues an indirect cost agreement. And all federal agencies then are required to honor that agreement. There are just certain programs that have legislative caps built into them that haven't been, we haven't been able to get those changed, like Head Start. I think this is my last slide. It was. Any questions?
Representative Kopp.
Well, thank you, Ms. Garza, for that excellent presentation. It's hard to overstate some of our ignorance on these issues, but first question, indirect rates costs, does that apply to both federal and state dollars that go to tribes?
Yes.
Okay.
Please continue.
The money that comes from the state to the tribes, is much of that money actually federal pass-through that the state administers as grants?
Well, the TANF dollars are passed through. The Head Start dollars, I understand, come from the general fund because the Head Start program requires tribes to come up with a match, and tribes don't have that match. And so the state has stepped forward and provided that match. And for example, like with Tlingit and Haida, there's like 300 Head Start students served in the region and 50 employees, and so that match makes a big difference as to whether tribes can provide that service or not. I'm trying to think if there's another pass through. I think it's mainly the TANF program that's passed through.
Okay, how about the VPSO?
The VPSO is not a pass through. It's comes out of the state's general fund.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman, did you have a question?
Yeah, so thank you. On the issue of Head Start grants, I think it was the state's matching portion is $6.8 million. And can't quite remember how many Head Start programs there are on the state. Maybe you have it on the top of your head.
I apologize. I do not have that on the top of my head anymore. I retired.
Well,
I can tell you how much it is for Tlingit and Haida. You know, the program at Tlingit and Haida served 300 students with 50 employees, and not sure quite how many communities, because Rural CAP serves the other communities.
Well, I guess the point I wanted to get at, and I don't, again, mean to put you as well in the hot seat, but there was reference made in a Finance Committee hearing not too long ago that the $6.8 million, which is cut out of the budget at the moment, could somehow be sort of provided by these tribes in lieu of the state funding. And I beg to differ with that. And, I won't ask you to provide your opinion unless you're willing to, but it just seems to me that these tribes don't have that kind of unrestricted money lying around.
The only tribe in Alaska that has unrestricted revenue is Tlingit and Haida Central Council because of its settlement with the federal government over the taking of the Tongass. All other tribes are landless, and so they don't have any resources with which to generate revenue, nor do they have a tax base. And so they don't have unrestricted revenue, and so they cannot come up with the match for those services. So many tribes, like I said, will not apply for those kinds of grants that have a cap. And as far as I know, the major organizations in the state that provide Head Start are Tlingit Ngaida and RealCap. And they couldn't provide these services. I think it would be very challenging to continue to provide Head Start without the match, unless we could get Congress to change that requirement. So if you have any ins with Congress.
I'll make time for one more question, and then we'll move on to the next presentation. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the different areas of revenue and the distinction between the tribes, the corporations, and the relationship with the state and the federal government. And your last response to the question that spoke of the tribes don't have a tax base, they don't have a stream of revenue. Can you speak more to that, and also how the corporations contribute to funding for services? Because I think that will give clarification on how services are provided to the Alaska Natives in the expectation of how these things are paid for in relationship to the state and federal dollars. I think just an overall picture of how that is, because I think there was an assumption that tribes had a revenue stream, and in your previous statement was that they're very limited in that.
Ms. Garza, before your response, I do want to highlight and clarify that we will have representatives from regional and village corporation organizations presenting before this committee on Thursday in great detail about their revenue streams and investment in Alaska's economy. And so we don't expect, Ms. Garza, for you to be able to define that, because we know a lion's share of your work has been on behalf of tribes and tribal governments specifically. If there's any brief overview that you would like to provide, we welcome that.
Okay, well, I also served as the CEO for a Kluwak Union Corporation, which is a village corporation, so I'm familiar with both worlds. But there are a lot of differences. Tribes' membership is not the same as a corporation's membership. And the Land Claims Act passed in 1971, and you had to be enrolled by a certain date. If you were not alive on that date, then you are not a shareholder, unless you inherited shares from someone. So a Native is not automatically a shareholder anymore. They must have someone that gives them shares. For example, my children were born after the date, so they're not automatically a shareholder unless I gift shares to them. That's unlike tribes. Tribes define their own memberships, or citizenry, if you would like. And in Central Council's case, the membership is determined. If you were an original member, then all your descendants, you have to provide the family tree and birth certificates and all that, but then you become a member. So there are two different groups of people that are in corporations than are in tribes. And so if you want to blame anyone for this confusion, it's Congress that created this mess, if you will, because the corporations ended up with all the resources, the land, and the money from the Claims Settlement Act, but not the responsibility to provide services to the members, and the memberships aren't the same anymore. So it's a real confusion. So I understand your confusion.
Thank you. Ms. Garza, for your service to Alaska tribes and making time for to be here with us today. It's very evident from your presentation that there are strict boundaries and parameters with which tribes are expected to expend resources, and we appreciate your expertise and knowledge in this area. We will now turn our attention to a presentation from President Richard Chalyaish Peterson from Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska on the role and function of tribal consultation. President Peterson, please come forward, put your name on record, and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Richard Peterson. And thank you for this opportunity. It's humbling to follow two amazing Native women leaders as our former Lieutenant Governor and my former COO. So my presentation is going to be far less impactful than theirs, I guarantee you. But I do appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about what it is for tribes to have consultation. And tribes have been working with the federal government on tribal consultation for a very long time to the benefit of both sovereign entities. Tribal health, fish and wildlife, we have multiple models of successful consultation that has produced quality programs that are efficiently responsive to the needs of the communities. One of the examples that I'm going to use today is the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The 1994 Marine Mammal Protection Act included the ability for the Department of Commerce and the Interior to enter into co-management agreements with tribal governments and acknowledge that working with tribes would more likely achieve the goals of the Marine Mammal Protection Act than being managed by federal agencies alone. It is simply more efficient to hear from the local communities on local matters. I think everyone in this body can appreciate that local control aspects of tribal consultation. Bureaucrats from Washington, D.C. know very little about Alaska, and I think prove that quite often. So history of federal consultation. I won't go over all of these this morning, but I wanted to make a point that there are multiple consultation policies for a variety of departments, divisions, agencies, and programs within the federal government. Consultation isn't an abstract idea. There are successful models out there for better collaboration on program delivery on many different subjects. So who is involved with tribal consultation? Obviously, tribes. Tribal consultation is based on a government-to-government relationship. I appreciated Lieutenant Governor Valerie Davidson pointing out this isn't a race-based agreement. We are sovereigns. We have a citizenry often shared with the state of Alaska and the federal government, but it is not race-based. Agencies should be represented by decision makers, not low-level staff checking a box to report on consultation to their superiors. Quality consultation will result in direct action. And very often, I, as the president of Tlingit and Haida, I sit directly with those that run programs from commissioners on down. And high-level decisions are able to be made more efficiently because of that consultation. Again, I referred to the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There were multiple co-management bodies resulting from this act, IPCOM, the Marine Mammal Commission. There's a great handbook produced in 2016 on model Alaska Native consultation procedures. I do recommend that you read this. It's very informative and I think sets a great precedence. This is something concrete you can look to. Sometimes the unknown creates insecurity or fear, so this is a great resource to learn from and see that tribal consultation is not a bad thing. It provides local control and efficient policies that actually fit our communities. And again, when we talk the state of Alaska, I think local control is something we all strive for. And so working with the tribes, that you couldn't be any more local than local tribes. Benefits.
President Peterson?
Yes.
Is it possible, actually, we will make a copy of this act available to everyone on the committee. Just as a question, in your experience here in Southeast, in a lot of the villages throughout the communities that you serve, are the stronger governments that typically provide services to residents of a community, tribes or municipal governments or both?
So I think I have a unique perspective because I was the mayor in my village for 13 years, served on the council for 18, and I was the tribal president for 18. And I can tell you that it was the tribe, because of the federal funding that we were able to bring into our communities, were really the doers. In my community, we were able to build a new school, partnering with our school district because of tribes. So we're far more involved in game management and wildlife management. So yes, I think tribes.
Thank you. Please continue.
So again, the benefits, local infrastructure, facilities, and human resources, creating efficiencies, providing services in the most remote communities, local solutions to local problems, federal oversight, efficiencies in overcoming real world issues, in many cases saves lives in rural communities. Formal representation, being on the record is really important. Myth busting, we're able to dispel some of the things that people believe. One of those I often find, land of trust. Many people think that's a land grab, giving millions of acres to tribes when it couldn't be further from the truth. Land of trust literally means land I, as a tribe already owned, can negotiate with the federal government to put into a trust status. Does not change anything for regular members of the community. So saves taxpayer money by identifying efficiencies, and again, communication and overcoming bureaucracy. Other issues that we face, and that were really good consultation, the governor's tribal advisory council, which I believe I was on that, and I think it's gone away, but I know with this new administration, some people have been changed and gotten letters thanking them for their service. I've never received one of those letters, so I'm just assuming I'm still on the GTAC and it still exists. I don't know. Department of Interior Secretary's Tribal Advisor Committee. Our very own Vice President Will Micklin sat on this committee, and it's a very important committee in the federal government. So future consultations that were, the BIA Reorganization Act, we're involved at that level. We meet with the Secretary of Interior to discuss these things. Right now we're requesting, and these have direct impact on Alaska, and that's why I bring these. With the EPA, we're requesting consultation right now to talk about mixing zones, which affect the Clean Water Act. I think many of your constituents, I'm looking at Representative Ortiz, I can tell you, those that are affected by the cruise ship industry and the mining industry, these are big issues. So the fact that the tribe is able to consultate on a federal level, I think cannot be underscored enough. And really that just concludes it. When it's, tribal partnerships, Lieutenant Governor Davidson referred to the compact quite a bit, and this was us signing actually a 4E agreement between the tribe and the state of Alaska when she was the commissioner, and feel very blessed to have been a part of that process. And then just last, there's this this slide gives a consultation is just the beginning. We feel like it will get better the more consultation we do. And I think, again, through Madam Chair, Vice Chair Edgman, your wisdom in forming this committee is instrumental in this. And I hope that we're gonna make a difference in this consultation by providing testimony. And when I look around the room, I appreciate that you admit what you don't know. And when we start with what we don't know, we can start getting to those answers. So I applaud all of you for your interest in this committee. And again, I think last week when I was here, I would encourage your Senate side to do the same. So with that, Chief Hawa, and I'll take any questions. And I promised you I was gonna be less impactful than the previous speakers, and I think I delivered on that, so.
Representative Edgman has a question.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Richard, for the presentation. Very good presentation. I think it followed very nicely the two previous presentations. But I think a pretty obvious a question that would generate a pretty obvious answer, but it's safe to say that anything that we've talked about today has very little reference in state law.
Yes. That's unfortunate.
Goodness, Chish, President Peterson, for your time here with us today, for joining us for a second hearing and talking about the function of tribal consultation at the federal level and the opportunities that exist at the state level. We also very much appreciate your ongoing work for your people and all tribes in Alaska, so thank you.
Chish, how for the opportunity.
I'd like to invite Ms. Davidson back to the table for any closing comments on tribal consultation, contracting, and compacting to help us close out this morning.
Guyana, Madam Chair, I also wanted to echo the comments by President Peterson. I love this committee. And, you know, sometimes it's so easy to continue to see the color orange until we have the opportunity to have the experience that allows us to be able to see the color green. And I think this committee allows that to happen, for people to be able to get their questions answered in a really safe environment in ways that are really helpful. So I wanted to talk about some of the myths that I've commonly heard in my career in tribal health and in compacting. So we've heard things like, well, you know, tribes just really aren't sophisticated enough. They don't have enough experience to be able to take on these complicated programs, when in fact, if you look in Alaska, some of the most world-renowned health programs that exist in our state are actually tribal health programs. Our telehealth system in Alaska that benefits people who live in places where they don't have a physician or don't have a surgeon or don't have a cardiologist. They're able to get that service through telehealth. The Dental Health Aid Therapy Program, the first mid-level dental program of its kind in the United States, actually began in the tribal health system. The NUCA model, the system of care that's being provided through South Central Foundation, is renowned throughout the world as one of the best health programs in the world. And so there are so many rules, and we've just really touched upon some. I know that Ms. Garza talked about some of the indirect cost rules, and you could see, and that was just a really high-level overview, you can imagine. I always smile really big at the finance folks when they're doing their indirect cost proposals because they are very, very technical, and there are so many rules around how that works, what's in, what's out, and they do literally look at every single penny that is spent. And so when you have a federally approved indirect support rate that's established, you know that it has been thoroughly vetted repeatedly. And so on that point, I just want us to remember that sometimes a great idea happens, and it was a great idea at that moment in time, but as we learn more information over time, it's not such a great idea anymore. And so the indirect caps that are on right now that were placed statutorily maybe made sense at the time, but they may not make sense anymore because their costs will continue to change, and the cost of fuel goes up, the cost of everything goes up, just like for anybody else. And so caps, unfortunately, are really a very effective vehicle of shifting costs from the person who's cutting the check to the provider of that service. And so if the state or the federal government is implementing an indirect cost cap and it has not changed over time to be able to meet basic inflation, then we know that that is merely a cost shift, and that's not keeping up with the actual cost of doing business. And tribes and tribal organizations, when they're providing those services, have to operate like a business, just like anybody else. And so it's really important to look at the way that things have always been done and ask ourselves the question, is that really appropriate? It was a great idea at the time, perhaps, but is that rate appropriate any longer? Especially when we have this other system that is already really looking at vetting what that indirect cost proposal should be.
So, Ms. Davidson, along that same line of comments, I just want to make sure that I fully understand. Indirect rates are federally established rates, and the loss to tribes when costs are not allowable are real financial losses, and there are typically not revenues that come into tribes to make up that difference. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to comment on is I loved Representative Vance, I loved your question about how, because there's still a lot of confusion about what's the role of ANCSA regional corporations, what's the role of ANCSA village corporations, how does that, are they different than, for example, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation? It also has the name corporation, but they're different. And how do they relate with tribes? So the tribal health organizations that may have the name corporation in their title are really tribal health organizations and tribal organizations. They are nonprofit organizations that have a different standing. They're not a profit-oriented business. They do have to operate like a business. They have to cover their costs just like everybody else to be able to keep their doors open and to continue to provide quality service, even when they're only funded at 50% of the level of funding needed. The regional corporations and the village corporations were really designed by Congress as a for-profit business mechanism, and they are not a part of, their function is not about providing social services or providing other kinds of services to the community. They often will do that, but sometimes when I worked in other jobs, I would get questions like this. Well, we need resources to be able to provide health services. Well, can't the regional corporation do that? Can't the village corporation provide that? And my response was often, well, those are two different functions. One is a for-profit that's really designed to do that, and the other is a social services or a healthcare organization that's a nonprofit. And so just as we wouldn't ask Kars or Fred Meyer or Safeway to pay for the healthcare costs or the social services costs of a community, we should not necessarily ask those for-profit companies in the ANCSA corporation realm to be able to do that, because they serve entirely different functions. Now, sometimes just as Kars or Fred Meyer or other companies may make a charitable contribution to a nonprofit in their community, like Beans Cafe or whatever, they have that authority, and they do that, and they get a tax break for that, which is helpful for both parties. Sometimes the ANCSA regional corporations and village corporations will similarly do something on that side. But again, they're really separate functions. And I think it doesn't help sometimes when we have our naming, when we name things in a way that's also, that may be a little bit confusing to that as well. I guess I went a little bit longer than I intended, but I really have to say I applaud the creation of this committee. I applaud the chair for creating a safe space to be able to have these kinds of conversations and to really look at the incredible level of sophistication that occurs within the services that are provided by tribes, and they are providing those services not just to their members, but to everyone who lives in the community. We all benefit from that service that's provided. And finally, while those opportunities have existed in Alaska for some time, state compacting opportunities really are at their infancy. And just as those other opportunities for federal compacting in health and social services and natural resources and transportation have occurred in the IHS compact or this Health and Human Services compact and the BIA compacts, we have those same opportunities to make those same strides through state compacts with tribes. But they have to be adequately funded in order for them to be successful. We need to make sure that we set people up for success and we don't just merely transfer the responsibility without any of the resources. And with that, Koyana to the committee and Koyana to the chair. And doi, one of my favorite Yupik words in a Yupik meeting, someone says doi. That's it.
Thank you, Ms. Davidson, for your time here with us today and for your insight and helping to inform us so we can all function from the same foundation of knowledge. Thank you. This Thursday, March 14th at 8 a.m., we will be hearing presentations on other Alaska Native entities and their role in Alaska's economies. Representative Vance, as we mentioned, and to hopefully delve into your questions a bit more. The time is 9:31 a.m. and this hearing of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs is now adjourned.